Which means I was really silly for not going away this week. Maybe next week. You know, next week we'll talk about Purim. Okay, that's okay? So in this week's parsha, God tells Moshe about all kinds of things that need to be collected. Vayedaber Hashem al Moshe lemor, daber al bnei Yisrael v'chuli truma me'eis kol isha sheyidvenu libo tikchu atrumasi. It talks about giving gifts, giving or donating, and then the lists begin of all kinds of precious metals, of materials. Although initially we're not told what the reason is, or what the purpose is, or what the objective is. Afterwards, in verse 8, Pasuk Ches, it says, Va'asuli mikdash, make for me a sanctuary, vishachanti bisocham, and I will dwell within you. And you don't have to know Hebrew that well. Okay, you know what, I take that back. Anyone who knows Hebrew will realize that the verse here doesn't work that well. It should have said, Vasuli mikdash, make for me a sanctuary, vishachanti bisocha, and I will dwell within it. Instead it says, make for me a sanctuary, vishachanti bisocham, and I will dwell within them, within the people. And by the way, this isn't a mistake, it isn't an accident, it's not the only time it says it. It seems to be quite clear that the objective of making the Mishkan is not because that, thank you, that God forbid that God is homeless. It's not that God has been living out on a park bench for the last 2,449 years. That's a lot of newspapers. That's just not the way that it is. It's not that God is homeless. It's not that God needs a place. It's not that God needs. And by the way, when you notice now in the very beginning, v'chuli truma, that phrase is also very difficult to translate. The easy way to translate it is, bring for me truma, or v'chuli truma, make me the truma, make me the gift. Over here it says, v'asuli mikdash. Does it mean make for me a sanctuary or make me your sanctuary? I'm not going to dwell on this because you'll get bored. You're probably already bored. But I want to continue a little bit. When it goes through all of the details and the things that need to be brought, it finally tells us that there's going to be an ark which is inside this sanctuary. And on the ark, they're instructed to make what's called a kruv, or a plural is kruvim. The English is cherubs. Do you know what a cherub looks like? You do know what it looks like, okay? So the artist's popular rendition, which is probably nothing to do with it, would be probably something not that dissimilar to Cupid. You know, we always read this parsha right near Valentine's Day, so I guess that's min hashamayim. But that's not exactly what it looks like. First let me read what it says about it. It says that you should make these cherubs. It says you should make two of them. The two of them should be made out of gold. That means that there's going to be some kind of figurines made out of gold, and not only make them out of gold, make them out of one piece of gold. So one piece of gold should be somehow formed into these two. It says that their wings are supposed to touch, so their wings come off on the top, and they have faces looking at one another. The Torah does not give us a great deal of detail what they look like. When we start going through various sources, then we get a much better idea what they look like. The Zohar says something which is very, very, very clearly, which could be discerned from other sources, but the Zohar says it clearly, and that is that one of the Kruvim was male, and one of them was female. Rashi, in a number of different places, tells us that a kruv looks like an infant, looks like a baby. So you have this something between angelic slash baby faced figurine made out of gold with wings outstretched, which are touching. And if that's not enough for you, it tells us that this is supposed to be placed on top of the ark inside this Mishkan, inside the temple, the tabernacle. It says, then subsequently, you're going to place within it the testimony which God will give you. And those of you who follow Rashi here, that the Chet Egel took place before this, are going to have a hard time with that verse. Because he says, the testimony which I will give you. And then, I'm skipping a little bit, it says, then God will then speak to you. Well, the voice of God will come down from heaven and emanate from these kruvim. Can I ask you an annoying question? What in the world is going on here? What's the difference between this and the golden calf? Okay, they're very, very different. Okay, we got that out of the way. What if, yeah, what's the difference between them?
One's commanded from Hashem.
Okay, good. So here we have a procedural difference. And according to your procedural difference that God commanded one, that means it just as easily could have been the other way around. It just as easily could have been that God said, make two calves, put them inside the temple, and put them on top of the ark, and that's where I'm going to speak to you. And then when they're waiting and waiting and waiting for Moshe to come down, they get very frustrated. And what do they do at the end? They make a cherub, and they worship that. So you're saying it would have been exactly the same. Are we all satisfied? Is this a little disturbing? I mean, is there really a difference in essence between the cherub and the golden calf? And by the way, any of you who are well-versed in the vision of Yechezkel, both as described in the first chapter and in the tenth chapter, you will realize that the relationship between the calf and the cherub is probably closer than any of us would feel comfortable. The Ramban makes note of that in a couple of places. But what's the difference? What's the difference between the two? And more to the point, what is going on over here? By the way, the Gemara makes it a little bit more exciting and more difficult. Because not only are we told that they look like male and female, and not only, well, I'll add one more point, according to the way the sources tell us, they were also naked. And the Gemara tells us that it happened when the temple was destroyed the first time, the heathens broke into the temple. They went into the Holy of Holies, and they find the two Kruvim embracing one another, holding one another tightly. Rashi there explains in the Gemara, holding one another tightly, it says, embraced in an embrace of love, like a man would embrace his wife. And it says that the heathens took these figurines, took these cherubs, dragged them outside, and put them in the street, and said, Yisrael halalu, these Jews, shebir chasan bracha uklalasan klala, the Jews who normally, their blessing is a blessing and their cursing is a curse. What does that mean? The Jews normally have a heightened sense of morality. We have a finely tuned moral compass. We know what's right and we know what's wrong. Yisrael halalu, these Jews, their blessings are blessings and their curses are curses. What they deem holy is holy, what they deem unholy is not. Ya'askub dor me'ele will be involved in this kind of behavior? Which means when the heathens dragged it outside, what did they see? They saw child pornography. That's your language. In their language, they may have seen something else.
Can you close this?
In their language, they may have seen something else. They may have seen a male and a female idol embracing, maybe even more than that. And they may have seen what in their mind was a symbol of fertility, but a symbol of fertility dealing with idolatry. And what kind of a message was this? Or what kind of news was this? The Jews who claimed to be moral, the Jews who claimed to disdain idolatry, the Jews who claim that they pray to God and they don't need any of these pagan primitive or primitive pagan symbols, Yaskuba Devar Me'ela, the Jews are involved in this? And the Gemara then quotes a verse, it says, a verse from Eicha, from the first chapter. Eicha, of course, is the book that was written by Yirmiyahu when the temple was destroyed. It says, Kol machmadeha hiziluha ki ra'u ervasa. All of their cherished things, hiziluha is means from the word zol, cheap. All their precious things became cheap, for they saw her nakedness. The Gemara says that refers to this scene where the pagans drag out the Kruvim and just start laughing at the Jews, and maybe even a little disappointed. You know, even pagans want someone to look up to. Even pagans would like to imagine there's someone out there who's moral. Even the pagans would like to imagine that the Jews... By the way, that's one of the reasons that anti-Semitism takes place, is when Jews don't live up to what we're supposed to live up to. And they say, Jews, this is what they're doing? This is how they're behaving? They should know better. And of course, you can all say, well, people are people are people. And you know what? It's true. But there's a price to pay for receiving the Word of God. So, the exact thing that bothers us, we're told actually happened. So I'll go back again and I'll ask you, what in the world is going on? Why did we have this? Why do we need this? Being that none of you have an answer yet, let me take a little side point and give you some time to think. Does anybody know exactly what the position of the Kruvim was in the temple? Did they? You don't know. They faced one another? That's what it was? Sometimes. What? Actually, the Gemara in Baba Basra points out a contradiction. It says, on the one hand, it says, and it brings one verse, it says that they faced one another. On the other hand, there's a verse that says that their backs were to one another and they faced the walls. And the Gemara says, you can't reconcile this. That if you say they faced one another, then the other verse can't be understood. If you say they didn't face one another, then the other verse can't be understood. And the Gemara says you have a contradiction, and it sounds like there's no way to get out of it. And then the Gemara nonetheless reconciles it. What does it say? It says it depends. It says that the Kruvim were a spiritual barometer of the relationship between God and the Jewish people. When the people were doing the will of God, they looked at one another. When the people were not doing the will of God, they turned away, which leads some commentators to understand that the Kruvim therefore represent God and the Jewish people. As I said, that's not clear in any source, but it's people understand it from this passage in the Gemara. By the way, if that's the case, how should the Kruvim had been positioned at the moment of destruction? They should have been running away, been other sides of the room. They should have been other sides of the room, you know, in a fetal position on the floor. By the way, do you like this idea of having a barometer to know how the relationship is going? If we can make some of these, you can sell people going on dates. The shidduch process can be very easy. Even that one day a year gives an indication what's going on. By the way, it probably helps the Kohen Gadol daven to a great extent. But still, nonetheless, this is very problematic and it's very troubling. Because why in the world would the Kruvim be involved in an embrace? Do you realize what the answer is? What's the answer?
Everywhere.
That at that particular moment, what was going on? At that particular moment, what was going on? At that particular moment, the Jews must have been unbelievably close to God. Do you realize how tragic this is? Okay, let me help you a little bit. There was a prophet named Jeremiah. He's not the first one, but it's probably one of the saddest stories. He's had visions. He knows what's going to go on. He's seen the future, and it's not pretty. What's going to happen? The temple's coming down. What's going to happen? The Jews are going to exile. What's going to happen? They're going to be slaughtered. What's going to happen? The blood is going to flow in the streets. What's going to happen? The women are going to be raped. What's going to happen? The Jews are going to lose their pride, their identity, and their purpose. If you had information like this, if you had knowledge of what's going to happen, you know, you can go crazy from such a thing. And you walk around and you tell people, God said the temple's going to be destroyed. You're going to go into exile. You know what people said? No way. Can't happen. You know why? Because the temple is the house of God. Because the temple has such profound holiness. Because the temple has the Spirit of God within it. What force can possibly come and destroy the temple? It's impossible. It can't happen. By the way, do you realize, if that's the case, how spiritually damaging the temple would be? Because you can do whatever you want, and you always know the temple is going to be there tomorrow. You can do any sin that you want, and tomorrow you'll bring an offering. You can do whatever you want as a people, and believe deep inside nothing will ever happen. By the way, it's not by accident one of the prophets later on says, Chesed chafatzti v'lo zevach. It was your kindness that I wanted, not your offerings. Do you think God really needs more and more burnt offerings? Do you think in heaven God has this big collection over there and he cherishes every single barbecue that he has? It's an absurdity. Now, I'll just say this for a second. The only reason that sacrifices works, and this is especially true according to the Ramban, is that when you slaughter the animal, you're supposed to have a powerful cathartic experience. You're supposed to think at that particular moment that the thing that was supposed to die was me. You're supposed to feel that because you sinned, you forfeited your existence. You're supposed to feel that as the neck is being punctured with the sharp blade, that it's your own. And somehow when you survive that experience, you're supposed to feel that you came back to life, you've been reborn. You're supposed to feel that God gave you another chance. You're supposed to feel that you were at the cusp of death, and now God in his infinite kindness has said, I'm going to give you another chance. Which means you should walk away from this offering transformed. You should walk away with a totally different direction in life. But God says, you got cynical. And what did you do? At the end of the day, you said, okay, what's my bill for today? How many offerings do I need to send? Check is in the mail. Right? Make a little donation to the building committee. Everything is fixed. Everything is good. And God says, Chesed chafatzti v'lo zevach. It was your kindness that I wanted. It was your decency that I wanted. What I was concerned about was how you were treating other people, not that you were bringing me offerings. I never needed the offerings. Chesed chafatzti. Below Zevach. Which, by the way, if you really now think deeply, what will you realize? The temple wasn't working. It wasn't bringing people closer to God. And therefore, what does God do in his kindness? He destroys the temple because it's not working. But now let's think again about Yirmiyahu. Yirmiyahu goes through these streets. He walks this cobblestone right outside. And he says to the people, it's going to be destroyed. And the people think he's mad. The people think he's crazy. It can't be. The temple destroyed? It can't be. Nothing can destroy it. Which means they believed in God sufficiently that nothing can destroy the temple. And therefore, they were allowed to do anything they wanted to do. You like it? But the only religious people can act like this. Because we figure, you'll do a mitzvah today, then you can do any sin you want tonight. Okay, non-religious people do that also. Because when it comes down to it, we're very childish, and we think we can bribe God. We think that we can make God's day. We think we can make God so very happy. And now if you think back at Yirmiyahu, he's telling the people, God's going to destroy it. And no one believes it. The parties are going on. The music is blasting. Everyone's having a good time. And then what happens? And then the enemy arrives. And they surround the city. And they breach the walls of the city. And they're shocked that the walls of the city come tumbling down. And what happens afterwards? They enter into the Temple Mount. And who can walk into the Beit HaMikdash? Who can walk into the Holy of Holies? Anybody walks in there, there's so much holiness, they should die immediately. And what happens? They walk in, nothing happens. And they walk in. And by this point, I want you to tell me, what are the Jewish people doing? Suddenly it hits them. It's going to be destroyed. Suddenly it hits them. That guy Yirmiyahu, he wasn't crazy. That guy Yirmiyahu, he's the only guy that forecasted exactly what was going to take place. I don't know if any of you have ever had an experience that your entire worldview is destroyed like this, and you realize that everything you thought was good is bad, and everything you thought was sacred isn't, and everything that you found comfort in disappears. They found comfort in the temple, and it was gone. And what did they start to do at that moment? They started to pray. They started to pray. Can you imagine how they prayed at that moment? Can you imagine how you would pray when you realize that you've been wrong for so long? Can you imagine how you're going to pray when you realize that every single step that you've been taking has been absolutely going in the wrong direction? And how do I know that they prayed? Because the crew of them were holding on to one another. They weren't only facing one another, they were holding on to one another in an unbelievable embrace. By the way, have any of you ever heard a tradition that says that the Messiah is born, or the soul of the Messiah was created on Tisha B'Av? You've heard such a thing? Rav Tzadok HaKohen from Lublin says, at what moment was it created? It was the result of all the prayers of those people on that day. By the way, that's a profound point. Because sometimes we think that if we pray and God doesn't acquiesce, that God doesn't obey us, that means that those prayers were ignored. That's not the case. Now, a number of years ago, there was a soldier who was kidnapped. And it was Nachshon Waxman. Nachshon Waxman's parents are religious. He was religious. He was kidnapped, trying to get a ride home. And there was, by the way, something very special about the parents. The mother was American, the father was Israeli. They're very, very special people. And they were interviewed while they were waiting for him to be released. And there was something about them that was able to galvanize the entire state of Israel, and people all over the world. They had a prayer down by the Kotel. Over 50,000 people came to pray. People with knitted kippot, people with black kippot, people without kippot. All kinds of people were there praying. And there was a feeling that if all these people come together, that those prayers have to be answered. There was a feeling that God has to obey us. And then on the following fateful Friday night, Israeli intelligence found out exactly where he's being held. And they sent special forces in. And as they broke through the door, one of the terrorists shot Nachshon and killed him. And one of the special forces that came in was killed as well. And during the Shiva, a particularly stupid, insensitive reporter interviews Nachshon's father. And he said, what happened to all the prayers of all those people? And his father said, sometimes God says no. But he also added another point. And how do you know without those prayers that all of the special forces would have been killed when they came through the door? And I'll add, And how do you know that all those prayers didn't prevent the next soldier or the next yeshiva student or the next secular kid from Tel Aviv from being kidnapped? We're going to start playing God's accountant. We're going to start figuring out what each prayer does. What Rav Tzaddik is saying is that every single prayer has an effect. The Gemara says that God collects every single tear and he holds it and it's precious to him. It's just we can't force God's hand. We can't decide what the end is going to be. We can't decide what is better and what is worse. We can't force conclusions. But if any of us think that God ignores the prayers, God forbid. He hears every single one and chooses to use them as he sees fit. And that's what Rav Tzaddik is saying. At the moment the temple is destroyed, the Kruvim are holding on to one another. In other Hasidic writings, they say it's slightly different. They say that before when a couple is married, before the husband would go on a business trip or go off out of the country for a while, he would need to satisfy his wife. So it says that the Kruvim, together at that moment, being intimate, says the Jews are about to go into exile, but there's this incredible closeness at this point between God and the Jewish people. There's intimacy at that point. Which again is an amazing thing. What it's saying is that even at the point of destruction, there's a closeness between God and the Jewish people. And by the way, in case you don't get this and you don't understand this, it's not making any sense to you, God could have destroyed the Jewish people. Instead, he destroyed a building. I mean, just think about it. Tragedies take place sometimes. Buildings burn down. And if a building burns down, what's the first thing that you say? And no one's killed, what do you say? Thank God. It's just the building. The fact that God, in the language of the Medrash, that God poured his wrath on stones and not on the people, that itself is incredible compassion, which sometimes you can't actually see. Now, all this helps us a little bit, but it doesn't solve our main problem. Why in the world do we have these particular figurines standing inside the Holy of Holies, which could easily be misunderstood by the pagans, and now we learn, in fact, they were misunderstood. So let me make a methodological observation. Whenever you want to understand the essence of something, the core of something, where it comes from, you need to study the first time it's mentioned in the Torah. Where did I learn that from? Rav Tzaddik HaKohen, the same one, says this. So now I'll ask you a simple question. This idea called the Kruvim, the cherubs, where is the first time they're mentioned in the Torah? Where do we find the Kruvim for the first time? Where exactly do you find them? Actually, not quite the Garden of Eden, but pretty close. We're told that when God exiles man, the end of chapter 3, V'yigaresh et ha'adam, God, and by the way, it's interesting, what does V'yigaresh mean? It also means the force, right? He sent them away. V'yigaresh et Adam, when God sent out Adam, v'yashken mikedem legan Eden et hakruvim. God put, but the word v'yashken also is very similar to Mishkan, very similar to Shechina. God placed east of Eden the kruvim, and he placed in their hands a revolving sword to guard the path to the tree of life. Which means man is exiled from the Garden of Eden. And what's there in their place? The Kruvim. This is the first time the Kruvim are mentioned. So how does this help us? And by the way, the word Vayeshken, as I said, Mishkan, is there as well. How does it help us? And what else do we find over here? We find us guarding the path to the Eitz HaChayim, to the Tree of Life. What is the Eitz HaChayim? Right. In the book of Mishle, it says, "Eitz Chaim hi l'machzikim ba." The Torah is a book of life for those who embrace it. Where were the Kruvim placed in the Mishkan? Right by the Aron, right by the Torah, right by the Luchos, right by the tablets, which means the position of the Kruvim vis-a-vis the Garden of Eden and the position of the Kruvim vis-a-vis the Mishkan is not all that different, and we need to pay attention to that. So if you want, we can stop there, and that's enough of the analysis, but I think it goes a little bit deeper. I think it's very simple. And the only thing that bothers me about what I'm about to tell you is that, to the best of my knowledge, no one ever said it, no one ever wrote it. Don't worry, you can't steal it yet. I wrote it in my first book, which I published in 2000, so I got you all beat already. I start thinking about the Kruvim. What do they look like? They look like babies. They look like angels. They look like babies, they look like angels, they look like angelic babies. They look like youthful angels. So give me a different word. What do they look like? What is there about babies? What is there about angels? What do they have in common? What's the common denominator? What's the word?
Purity.
Innocence. Purity, innocence. That means that they have a look on their face of incredible innocence. And I begin to go a little bit further then. They have innocence and they're naked and they're male and female, but they're innocent. And what emerges?
Adam and Eve.
And how old were Adam and Eve when they were kicked out of the Garden of Eden? Okay. Very young. Very young. Chronologically very young. Physically older. What's there about kids? Kids have innocence. And you know what's tragic? When you look in a kid's eye and you see that this kid's been damaged, you see that this kid's been around the block, you see that this kid lost their innocence. It's tragic when you see it. But can you imagine looking into an adult's eyes who still has that innocence? Can you imagine seeing somebody that still has that purity? Adam and Eve, before they sinned, had purity. They had innocence. What caused them to lose that innocence? It's a one-word answer. Starts with an S, three letters.
Sin.
Let's go to Eshet Torah, then it's a mistake. Sin caused the loss of innocence. And it's tragic. Why? What do you see? What happens? Beforehand, what are we told? That they're, by the way, you want to go a little bit sharper? The two cherubs, what are we told they're made out of? They're made out of one piece. What were Adam and Eve made of? They're made out of one. That should clinch it for most of you. Which means that these two cherubs are made out of one, and sometimes they're together, but sometimes they're alienated. Adam and Eve were made out of one thing. Which means, if you really think about it deeply, the Jewish concept of sexuality is related to intimacy, but not just physical intimacy. It's spiritual intimacy. It's intimacy to the extent that the physical union of two people, of Adam and Eve, who were literally soulmates because they were one and they were divided into two, but when they merge together and become one, they're going back to the original situation that took place. Which means the situation when they're not together is the abnormal situation. And Adam and Eve are made out of one, and the two cherubs are made out of one, and they're supposed to be inside the temple at least touching one another. And as we learned at the moment of destruction, they weren't just touching, they were involved in an intimate embrace. Not wanting to let go of one another. And now we look at Adam and Eve before the sin. Before the sin, they're naked. And how do they feel? How do they relate to this nakedness? They don't. It's complete innocence. The same way that a one-year-old just wouldn't mean anything. A one-year-old frolicking on the beach, right, without its diaper on, is not an exhibitionist. It's a child enjoying nature. There's nothing sick about it. There's nothing perverted about it. And from the child's perspective, it's just totally innocent the way it's supposed to be. And that's how Adam and Eve were with one another. But what caused them to lose their innocence? They lost it because they sinned. And what was the result of the sin? We're told that God tries to engage them. God tries to reach out to them. God tries to speak to them. And what happens? They hide. I don't know if there's a more pathetic verse in the entire Torah than Adam and Eve hiding from the voice of God. You know, it's like, again, like a two-year-old. You're playing hide-and-seek, and they're hiding under their blanket, and they think that because they can't see you, you can't see them. How exactly do you hide from God? Adam and Eve became jaded. They lose their innocence. Perhaps cynicism replaces innocence. But worst of all, there's a sense of alienation. And even God reaching out to them is something which is terrifying and something which is humiliating and something which is troubling. And all they want to do is move away. And by the way, do you realize what this teaches us? We think perhaps that when we sin, God moves away from us. It's not the case. When we sin, we move away from God. When we sin, we pull that blanket over our heads. When we sin, we're the ones who don't want to approach God. When we sin, we're the ones who are embarrassed and humiliated and can't stand in front of God. And God, for his part, calls out to Adam and says, Adam, Ayeka, where are you? Have you gotten lost? And again, I want to remind you, where are Adam and Eve? They're in the Garden of Eden. They're hanging out with God. They're chilling with the Lord. But what are they doing? They're hiding. They're embarrassed. Do you realize what else this means? They don't want to be there. They're in the holiest place that ever existed, where the voice of God is heard, discerned in the spirit of the day, and they're trying to hide from it. So God does them a favor. What does he do? He kicks them out. And what does he put in their place? He puts two cherubs, which therefore tells you that the cherubs replace Adam and Eve, who no longer can enter into the temple. They can't go in. Sorry, into the Garden of Eden. They can't go in. They can't enter. And they can't approach the Tree of Life. Because sin is the antithesis of life. And sin is corrupting. And sin changes our perspective. And sin doesn't let us see God who's right in front of us. Sin is distorting. God sends them away. 2,500 years later, God says to Moshe, it's time to build a Mishkan. Build for me a house. And what does he say? Build for me a house, and I will dwell within them, not within the house. God's presence is all over. I will dwell within them. Who's that? I will dwell within the people. What is the purpose of the cherubs? Now, you pointed out correctly that they're hardly ever seen. So why build something that no one can look at? So why can't we look at it? The point is, we can't look at it because we have a little bit of pagan in us. And we can't look at it because we are corrupt. We can't look at it because we lack sufficient spirituality to really see something which is spiritual. And what did the pagans see when they took it out? They saw child pornography. And the question is, what happens when you lose your innocence and you look at innocence? Do you see innocence? Or do you see something very different? And the people don't have sufficient holiness to walk inside and to see this image. Because what is the image? The image is something which is overwhelming. The image is Adam and Eve before they sinned. Can you imagine what it was like to look at that? One person, Aaron, a man who knew sin, How did he know sin? He was involved in the golden calf. A man who knew sin can walk inside once a year, and he needed to prepare himself. And when he prepares himself, he can go in and he can see this image. He can see the Kruvim. He can see this innocence. And then what's his job? To take a little bit of the holiness out and to try to teach the people. But it's not normal teaching. Can you imagine right now, forget about going into the Beis HaMikdash, forget about going into the Mishkan, forget about going in and seeing the Kruvim. Can you imagine looking into Aaron's eyes right after he walked outside? Which means now you're one step removed from eyes that saw holiness. Not just holiness, from eyes that saw innocence. And it's transformative. I had a friend, he's a very big rabbi today. Years ago, he heard about an elderly man who lived in an old age home in Brooklyn, New York, who grew up in a city called Brisk, who as a young man studied with someone known as Reb Chaim Soloveitchik. And he told me that he asked me for a ride to Brooklyn. I gave him a ride to Brooklyn. I said, where are you going? So he told me, I want to go and visit this fellow. And I said, why? He said, because I want to look into the eyes of somebody who looked at Reb Chaim while he was teaching Torah. I just want to look into his eyes. I want to see. Nothing else. I just wanted to see his eyes. Because he felt that there must have been so much holiness at that moment when Reb Chaim taught. If you don't know who Reb Chaim is, good, you have homework to do. But he felt there must have been so much holiness at that moment. He can read the books, but you read the books, it's a little different. He wanted to look into his eyes. And if you understand that, if you realize that, then you realize there's a song you sing on Yom Kippur, Mare Kohen, what the Kohen must have looked like, the Kohen Gadol must have looked like when he walked outside of the Holy of Holies. Do you realize what he looked like? He glowed. He glowed. He saw the Kruvim. He saw Adam and Eve before the sin. It's transformed. Now, just in case all of you think that we live in a corrupt world and all of us have lost our innocence and all of us are way too cynical, then realize it's only your cynicism that makes you feel that way. Okay? And what you have to do is you have to put the cynicism in check. And you have to say, there are things called purity. There is something which is called innocence. There is a situation that existed before sin, and it's very difficult, but it is within our collective consciousness. It is something which is attainable. There is an ability within man to try to get to that point before sin took place, before we felt that we need to run away from God. And every single time that we feel like moving, taking a step towards holiness, you should know that at that moment we're fighting that cynicism. And we're approaching innocence, we're approaching purity. Every single one of you got on a plane and came to Israel, that was a part of it. You were looking for holiness. Every single one of you who sit and study Torah, that's a part of the innocence. The truth is that Aaron went in on the day which was the holiest day in Yom Kippur. But as I've said many times, you can beat the holiday rush. You don't have to wait for Yom Kippur. That every single day that a Jew is willing to embrace God, that a Jew is willing to move towards God instead of hiding from God, where a Jew is willing to go back to that point where things are simple and not so complex, where there's a God around who loves us and cares for us, and even when things seem difficult, God is still doing what's best for us. At the moment when we're able to accept this and to believe this, then we have embraced the innocence within us. We have found that little Adam and Eve, which is still within us. It must have been unbelievable to look into Aaron's eyes, but you know what? We can still look into the eyes of our teachers, who looked into the eyes of their teachers, who looked into the eyes of their teachers. And you keep going all the way back, and they looked into the eyes of Moshe, and looked into the eyes of Aaron, and they looked into the eyes of Miriam. And you go all the way back, they looked into the eyes of Abraham and Sarah. We can still look into those eyes. All that we need to do is not act like Adam and Eve. not pull the blanket over our heads, not run away from God, but rather embrace, then we're able to find that innocence. Now we understand why God said to build a Mishkan. It wasn't that God was homeless. It's that we've become homeless. It wasn't that God was out on the street. It's that we were out on the street. It wasn't that God needed to find a place. It's that man needed to find himself. And the self that man needed to find was that self that was lost with sin all those years ago. And God takes an image of Adam and Eve, places it inside the temple. You can't look at it every day. It's a little too much to approach all the time. But we need to know that it's there, it's possible, it's attainable. That innocence could be reacquired. Have a good Shabbos.